Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Perfect Match, a Valentine's Day novella by Melina Mackay. Narrated by Abby Craden. You have to have courage to love somebody because you risk everything. Everything. Maya Angelou. 1. Where our heroines meet in a very romance novel appropriate way. Abby. As a newly appointed Cupid, Abby Angelini could not hold back her excitement as she watched Sin City grow closer in her airplane window. She hugged the pristine silver quiver that held her arrows to her chest and closed her eyes with a happy sigh. Then she immediately opened them again, because there was absolutely no way Abby was missing a single moment of her first Las Vegas Cupid convention experience. Every year for a week in February, the most distinguished Cupids of the world, along with the gods, muses, and other mythical creatures, flocked to Vegas for a gathering. The convention was massive, hosting dozens of workshops, panels, and creative discussions, all in the name of ensuring that people fell in love, that they found their perfect match. To become a junior Cupid and receive her bow and arrows, Abby had to attend the Cupid Academy, where some of the biggest experts in the field taught her. Rigorous testing and other challenges accompanied the grueling 2-year program in order to evaluate a future Cupid's suitability and to get them on the path of becoming a bringer of love. Abby had to take several useful classes like psychology, behavioral science, the basics of neurobiology, as well as the run-of-the-mill courses that she knew she'd never ever apply in her day-to-day Cupid duties, family law and statistics. The last one had felt completely over the top in terms of requirements, as she did not really understand its necessity. Still, she tried to apply herself because she knew that only the best of the best ever graduated and were singled out with an invitation to the most exclusive assembly in the world, the Vegas Cupid Convention. Throughout the millennia, since humans walked the Earth, Cupids had ensured that the species not only procreated, but also did so out of love. Sure, not all couples were together because of a Cupid's arrow, as these days. There were simply too many people and too few Cupids. But those who received the gift of an arrow were special indeed. Or at least that is what Cupid Academy students were told. Abby still remembered the dashing and always semi-undressed Apollo teaching the class on the perfect match. He was vain and liked to admire his own reflection in the windows and play with his hair in a seductive but too well-practiced way. Aside from good hair product suggestions, the only other insight Abby had gotten from his class was that a Cupid's arrow did not guarantee a happily ever after, but it always made for an amazing love story. Most Cupids tended to be overly eager and generous with their arrows. Spurred by the ever-growing competitiveness to make as many people as possible fall in love, those Cupids shot first and calculated the odds later. However, the best Cupids spent their arrows wisely and targeted couples who would be so compatible that their match would be perfect. It was considered a true science to find and bring those couples together. It was also a very challenging endeavor. And because it was so complicated, the majority of Cupids did not bother with it. In an attempt to increase their chances at a perfect match, they spent as many arrows as possible and brought as many people together as they could, playing the game of numbers. Their logic was that if you shot 100 arrows, your chances of getting at least one perfect match were much higher than if you just shot 10. Abby knew that there was an official running competition among Cupids, and every year at the convention in Vegas, Aphrodite herself announced the statistics. Who had shot the most arrows, who got the most people to fall in love and successfully start a relationship, and finally the most coveted stat of them all? Who had the highest percentage of perfect matches? That was a number everyone watched and wanted to come as close to as possible. For the past 10 years, there was only one Cupid in the entire world who held the perfect 100%, Sabine Goddard. Some claimed that the haughty and unapproachable New Yorker was not worthy of her crown as the queen of the perfect match. They said that, as a renowned economist and big-name financial shark, she had involved too much math and statistics into the fine art of love. Others deified and idolized her as the uncontested champion. Most feared her and knew nothing about her, other than what the Cupid statistics textbook told them during their classes with one of the muses. In Abby's class, Erato, the muse of erotic poetry and one of the professors at the Cupid's Academy, had told them, with a great deal of respect, and not a little drooling, that Ms. Goddard not only held the perfect 100% score for years, but had achieved it with the least amount of expended arrows. It was in this particular moment during the lecture that a huge discussion had ensued, and Abby idly and somewhat apprehensively stood by as her classmates launched into the positives and negatives of the perfect match, and why it was a completely outdated and obsolete romantic construct. This was, of course, coming from Darcy St. James and her coterie of four other prospective Cupids who went everywhere together, worked at an advertising firm, and generally were hip and trendy. It helped that Darcy's sister Madison was a running champion in the number of relationships established after the arrow hit. Madison had written her amorous PhD on the subject of the irrelevance of the perfect match and the importance of overall arrow expenditure. As in the more, the better, quantity, according to Madison, was the be-all and end-all of a Cupid's job. They had an unlimited number of arrows for a reason. They had to use them, thus giving more and more people the chance to find themselves in love. Damn the torpedoes. Abby, while a silent observer of the drama in her class, and one to not get overly aggressive about her beliefs, tried to understand both points of view. Erato and Apollo had extolled the beauty and superiority of the perfect match, the lifelong connection, the chemistry, the passion. Darcy, following in her sister's record-setting footsteps, raved about the sheer allure of seeing tens of thousands of people throw caution to the wind and fall in love. That night, Abby had gone home and continued to ponder the debate she'd witnessed and been a largely silent observer to. Should a Cupid just launch arrows in the endeavor to get people together? Or should a Cupid only shoot when a perfect match was in the cards? And how to even begin to spot one? Apollo had been thoroughly unhelpful in that aspect in class. Yes, he extolled the beauty of the supreme pairing, but he gave very scant information on what it was that made it, for lack of a better word, perfect. Love, absolutely. Passion, sure. But beyond that, Abby had gone to the romantic library to peruse a collection of books on the perfect match and realized that there was very little consensus on what made one. It simply was, and people knew it when they saw it. Oh, and Aphrodite got a special check mark in her register when the match occurred. That was it. All in all, very frustrating for a junior Cupid with many questions and no answers. She'd approached Erato after one of their classes, but the muse, helpful and solicitous while also always trying to seduce Abby, couldn't assist her much. Abby took no offense to the attempts at seduction. Erato wasn't the muse of erotic poetry for nothing. Her exploits were legendary, and Abby wasn't ready to become another notch on an already busy headboard. Erato seemed to take the rebuff in stride. After all, there was an abundance of fish in her pond, but stated that since Abby was such a sweet cinnamon roll, she'd be remiss if she didn't try and be helpful. They spent a whole evening in a discussion that ended first with Erato explaining what a cinnamon roll was, thank you, the Onion writers, and then postulating that, ultimately, the style of each Cupid was hers alone. You either subscribed to the more the merrier style and shot as many arrows as you wanted, hoping to spread as much love as possible, or you held tight and looked carefully and only released the bowstring when you thought the one true chance was in your sights. After extricating herself from a particularly hot and suggestive proposal from the amorous muse, Abby decided that reading and studying love wasn't the right way to go about things. Perhaps spreading it around, practicing her aim and her judgment for a good, if not necessarily a perfect match, was enough for now. Maybe practice really made perfect. Pun intended. After all, love was a good thing. Love was a blessing, and love was beautiful. Perfect match or not, love brought happiness and warmth as long as it lasted. That was Abby's reasoning when, the day after her graduation from Cupid Academy, she had tested her aim and shot her first arrows at two cute 20-something girls stealing furtive glances at each other across the aisle at her local library. Sue her. She wasn't prejudiced against heterosexuals, and believed that love is love. But family was family, and she wanted to see as many women who love women happy. So her first arrows would be for women. Decision made, she took aim and let her arrows fly. Afterward, she quietly returned her borrowed books and took one last look at her handiwork. The girls were shyly smiling at each other. Abby hadn't been able to stop grinning for days, thinking of those smiles. Knowing her fellow lesbians, without Abby's help, they'd likely have stared at each other at the library for months, then maybe, and that was a big maybe, introduced themselves and then promptly decided that the other saw them only as a friend. A date request would have been interpreted as a friendly hangout proposal, a movie night as two friends watching movies together. And if one of them confessed to the other she liked her, chances were pretty high that the other would have thought that it was only as a friend. With the help of Abby's arrows, their feelings would be stronger, more defined, and thus their actions more decisive and their attraction that much more explosive. A Cupid's arrow made people fall in love with all the bells and whistles that love brought. The happiness, the desire, the joy. Then life and the fates would take over. And if the match wasn't perfect, they'd break up. And a Cupid would try again, if they were very lucky. Abby had had a good feeling about this match, though. She'd crossed her fingers and hurried back home to her two cats, Orange, short for Orangeade, and Brown, short for Hash Brown. One of them would insist on cuddling with her, and the other would ignore her out of spite that she was cuddling his brother. They'd switch it up the next day, and their game of loving her and ignoring her would begin again. They were stray cats who'd chosen her as their human, and they occasionally allowed her to think she was the boss of them, but they truly only needed her for her opposable thumbs, to open their food, and for occasional belly scratches. She loved the little furry demons with all her heart. Abby's cozy L.A. apartment was a stone's throw away from the film studio where she was currently working as an assistant costume designer. In actuality, that just made her a glorified secretary, since the studio invited major costume designers who chose not to use her creative talent, but instead dispatched her for coffee or material supplies or who knew what other errands. But Abby, ever the optimist, was just waiting for her chance. One day, the studio bigwigs would see that she had talent and ideas, and they would transform her portfolio of historical pieces into real costumes. Then her name would finally appear in another line, other than assistant to Ms. So-and-so, costume designer. One shot. That was all she needed. Her own musings made her smile. Yeah, just one shot in either of her jobs. She tore her eyes away from the famous Vegas landmarks that were quickly becoming bigger as they approached the runway. Looking around, she noticed an elderly couple, a man and woman, sitting together, their heads bent close over a travel guide. She was talking excitedly about the prospects of all the casinos, and he nodded sagely, cautioning her jokingly that his dear friend Noah, long ago departed, would probably spin in his grave if he heard his widow was gambling away his fortune. The woman's laugh was infectious. Clearly, she had heard the admonishment before, and her eyes sparkled with mischief and possibilities. They shared a look, and Abby's fingers tingled. Her quiver felt too warm in her hands, and a second later, she was sending a couple of magical arrows their way. The man blinked on impact, and his grip on his companion's hand tightened for a second while her smile became thoughtful and warm instead of teasing. Later, Abby watched them meander toward the baggage claim, close together, their fingers touching with every step, yet neither made any attempt to move away. They looked at each other with new awareness, their smiles slow and shy. Abby sighed. Her work here was done, or just beginning. The world lay at her fingertips, and Vegas was a city of a million of possibilities. A cab ride later with the famous hotels, gaudy and kitschy, flying by her, Abby checked in with a harried receptionist at Bellagio, feeling pretty cool about herself for scoring a room at the most fabulous hotel on the Strip, while 1,000 other Cupids had to settle for smaller places, on the Strip if they were lucky, or on the outskirts of Vegas if they'd tarried with their bookings. With the convention being held at the MGM Grand Conference Center, the only venue able to host thousands upon thousands of Cupids at once, Abby would only have to walk for 10 minutes from her hotel to reach her daily destination. Plus, it was a good idea not to stay where the convention was held, in order to have some privacy, and it was also an opportunity to stretch her legs. The anticipation that never quite left her blood flared again, and she abandoned her luggage in the far corner of her twin room before messaging her former classmates from the academy and settling on dinner at the Venetian. She was sure they'd hit the clubs afterward, and while that wasn't quite her scene, she was still pretty excited to reconnect with her friends and share her latest adventures in spreading love. Sabine. Her plane had been delayed yet again, and she walked along the bustling rows of chairs arranged snugly around Gate 7. Sabine Goddard could not hide her frustration. This was a third delay of her flight from JFK to McCarran. Not that she was in any hurry to get to Vegas. In fact, if she could have avoided the blasted convention, she'd have been one happy Cupid. But she had been personally summoned, as always, by Aphrodite herself, who made a point of calling her at work and smirked knowingly at Sabine's displeasure through the 2-minute conversation. She couldn't see the smirk, of course, but the goddess's teasing tone was infused with it. Of course, Sabine was looking into any pretext to avoid the idiotic sham that was a Cupid's yearly meeting. She knew it, the gods knew it, even the muses knew it. Hence the call from the goddess of love herself. Aphrodite did not call just any Cupid to summon them to Vegas in no uncertain terms. Every year she made a point to ensure Sabine was there to accept the formal crown of the Queen of the Perfect Match. Sabine herself never kept track of the dubious achievement. She merely went about her business as a partner in the McManus, Urey & Goddard financial firm, and as a Cupid. Though while she loved the former, the latter still did not sit comfortably on her shoulders. After years, and especially after her personal trials and tribulations with love, she still could not reconcile the ideals with the realities of love and life in her mind. She loved her day job. Numbers suited her. She loved the certainty, the predictability, and the comfort of permanence in them. Numbers did not lie to you. The data would be the same, no matter how many days passed, how many late nights she pored over it, or how many work-related trips she took on behalf of the firm. Unlike a lover, who'd complain about those late nights and leave you one day with little explanation after you arrived home from a particularly grueling trip. Sabine closed her eyes, trying to dislodge the image of an empty townhouse and the rather dramatic broken glass of the frame that had held her picture with Elle strewn all over the floor. She normally did not veer towards dramatics, and she regretted that silly outburst. She was known for her composure and her cool demeanor. Those had suited her well throughout her career and ultimately during her divorce, when she gave Elle everything she'd wanted and left with her head held high and her dignity intact, despite her heart being in tatters. At least she managed to pull herself back together. After all, it was all so long ago, now just water under the bridge. Numbers were faithful, and numbers never let you down. People, on the other hand, even when people loved deeply and truly, they still hurt each other, badly. Sabine knew it all too well. As a Cupid, she saw plenty of love and plenty of happiness. But she also saw the ugliness of broken dreams and broken lives. Sabine knew that most Cupids never really knew what happened to the people they spent their arrows on. They had their tally. How many arrows shot, how many couples formed, how many broke up, and how many were a perfect match. She was fairly certain that most never bothered to do a follow-up on those couples who were either still together or had broken up. Truth be told, 15 years ago when she had gotten her quiver, Sabine had not bothered with the what happened afterward either. She was too happy to have officially become a Cupid to stop and think about the responsibility she held for those whose lives she upended on a whim. Yes, love was important. Love was glorious and exhilarating. But love was also painful, destructive, and violent. By following up on some of her arrows, Sabine learned the hard way that spending thousands of arrows and bringing hundreds of couples together was irresponsible. She'd seen domestic violence and abuse and pain. She'd seen lies and faithlessness and broken dreams. And so for the past 10 years, she had been extra careful. She barely spent 100 arrows a year, but her record spoke for itself. She had a 100% perfect match delivery. Some claimed that Sabine was not playing by the rules. God knows that awfully pretentious woman from L.A., Madison St. James, with her wild theories about shooting millions of arrows a year claimed that making hundreds of thousands of people fall in love was the way to go. The dreadful creature even wrote a thesis on the subject. Sabine could not disagree more. That was how people found themselves in violent marriages, how people made each other's lives a living hell. They had all started with wild Cupid-blessed love, only to be stuck in a less than perfect match. Her title of many years running, Queen of the Perfect Match, was something that gave her just as much discomfort as being a Cupid did. She disliked the attention, disliked the upheaval that flying to Vegas always caused to her life, and most importantly, she disliked the debates and the arguments she was always subjected to every time her crown was once again confirmed. It was all so tedious. She wanted to stomp her 4-inch heel, but took better care of her Pradas than that. She'd much rather be home with her faithful Labrador, who loved sleeping across her ankles, and who hated when she was out of town. Black, or as he was known on the International Labrador Retriever Circuit, Sir Emerson Blackmore III, was a champion who had won numerous medals in various canine contests. His bloodlines were pure, and his character unimpeachable. He was well-bred, well-trained, and impeccably mannered. Sabine loved all gorgeous, inky 70 pounds of him. That he was occasionally mischievous and often cuddly only made him even more perfect in Sabine's eyes, though she died before admitting that she loved his escapades or spent her evenings on the couch reading and holding him close, his big head snuggled heavily and warmly on her lap. Wondering how Black was faring in the fancy doggy hotel she deposited him this morning before heading to JFK, Sabine glanced at the board above the gate number, still announcing that her flight was delayed because weather conditions remained unfavorable. Who thought setting Valentine's Day in February was a good idea? Sure, it was summer in the Southern Hemisphere, but then they should have held the damn convention in Sydney instead of Las Vegas. By the time boarding was finally called, it was so late that she had no hope of getting into her hotel room at a decent hour and going to a nice steak dinner. Another gust of terrible weather over Nevada delayed her trip by an additional hour, flying aimlessly in severe turbulence, trying to outrun or at least move around the incoming storm. Being shaken at the seams for an extended time was not Sabine's idea of a good time. In fact, the stress of the flight exhausted her so much that by the time she finally landed and gathered her Vuitton from the baggage claim, Sabine was barely awake. For the life of her, she could barely remember the cab trip down to her hotel. She was out like a light, not even bothering to put on her pajamas or do more than take a very quick shower. Her hair still wet, she threw the robe on the twin bed next to hers and crawled naked between the silky sheets. One thing about these shindigs was unfailingly true. Bellagio was one hell of a hotel and delivered an exceptional experience for its guests. She did not manage to snag a suite this time and had to settle for a twin room, but some things were just good across the board, and Bellagio bedsheets were one of them. She'd see about an upgrade tomorrow morning. She had been too wiped out to be remotely coherent when she checked in, and from the look of the reception clerk, so was he. Tomorrow, she thought, slipping into a deep sleep. 2. Where there is a lot of confusion and nudity. Abby. Abby tried to stifle a yawn as she said goodnight to her friends and classmates in front of the hotel. Out of the entire group, she was the only one who had managed a booking at Bellagio, and the gaggle of girls all oohed and awed appropriately at her luck. Ulrika, one of the Norwegian Cupids and Abby's academy classmate, had the booking closest to her location, having barely managed to snag a room at the Paris. The rest would be looking for Ubers to take them to the outskirts of the city, to their less reputable hotels. The night had passed in a blur of great food, money lost at the slots and roulette, and in smoky clubs. Abby did not indulge too much in alcohol, but she still drank more champagne than usual, and had a nice mellow buzz going. She wasn't drunk or even really tipsy, but she felt on top of the world. She was in Vegas, with her friends, and about to begin her first Cupid's convention. This was the life. This was her life. In her exhilarated state, she'd even shot two arrows inside the club, at their waitress, a harried and exhausted-looking blonde who was extraordinarily nice to them despite her obvious tiredness, and the bouncer kept giving her concerned looks and helped her twice when overly aggressive customers were being fresh with her. If he'd hit one of those guys a bit too hard for the infraction he committed, Abby could not have faulted him. The girl was petite as a waif and carried around huge trays loaded with drinks. She did not need to be aggravated or disrespected by the wandering hands of all sorts of assholes. And if the bouncer, a guy probably three times her size, gave her soft, longing looks, who was Abby to judge? All she could do is make sure that their potential love story blossomed fully. So all was well in her world. When the Nevada sun rose again, she'd attend her first convention. She had looked at the agenda beforehand. The event would open with a huge welcoming speech by Aphrodite herself. Abby tried not to fangirl much. Truth be told, the goddess of love was beyond beautiful. She'd only seen her once, at the graduation ceremony, and judging by all her swooning classmates, Abby was not alone in her appreciation for the goddess. But something else left Abby full of anticipation, perhaps even more so than the prospect of seeing Aphrodite. The convention's opening ceremony would mark the announcement of yearly achievements, and she'd see the one Cupid she was most excited to be in the presence of. The queen of the perfect match would be announced. And Abby was afraid she'd embarrass herself with her fangirling. It was a fairly certain bet that Sabine Goddard would win again. She was the absolute master when it came to the art of the perfect match. Abby wondered what it would be like to meet the woman. She was supposedly in her late 30s and gorgeous, judging by the picture in the statistics textbook. Abby might have stared at the image a bit too long, but who could blame her? Sabine was stunning. All that thick, dark hair that shone like silk and looked impossibly soft, and those piercing green eyes that reminded Abby of early spring leaves, so vivid, so alive. The picture projected confidence and self-assuredness. None of the rumored unapproachability and arrogance. None of the aloofness and reserved iciness. Of course, the book didn't mention any of the above. But Abby had heard plenty of gossip from Darcy via her sister during their classes. Sabine Goddard's rivalry with Madison St. James was legendary. Madison held the absolute record for the total number of arrows shot in the last 10 years, and Sabine was the reigning queen of the perfect match. Abby had met Madison several times, and if she was to believe anything she'd heard about Sabine, the two Cupids' personalities could not have been more opposite. Madison was vivacious, extroverted, and popular. She exuded openness and had some kind of cutesy nickname for everyone. Abby wasn't sure she was exactly into all that. It seemed presumptuous to simply call someone baby without actually knowing their last name or anything about them. Did that make Abby naive or provincial? Perhaps. She certainly did not feel sophisticated enough when Madison and Darcy were around, with their blonde locks and fashionable clothes, or their supposedly forward-thinking ideas of cupiddom. Still, Abby typically took all this in stride. She was hardly a popular kid, either these days or back in her braces-wearing high school years. But no matter how many times Darcy or Madison disparaged the queen of the perfect match, Abby could not help but feel that the abuse was ill-deserved. Sabine Goddard was an enigma. Nobody really knew her. Everything that was said about her was drawn from rumors or innuendos. Abby had to admit, the mystery only added to her allure. Even Hermes himself, who knew everyone, everything, and was the chief gossip spreader in their world, hedged when asked about Sabine Goddard. He just shrugged his broad shoulders, flung back his curls in the true school of Apollo's hair flip, and changed the subject. But he did stop Darcy and her gang from badmouthing Sabine.
"I'd caution against saying much about the perfect match, Queen Ms. St. James. She's in the record books for a reason, and on top of it all, as much as it pains me of all the gods to say, nobody really knows her. She's a solitary Cupid."
A solitary Cupid. The turn of phrase he'd chosen told Abby that he wanted to convey that if anyone told you they knew Sabine Goddard, it was most likely not true, because nobody actually did. In Abby's eyes, the prospect of meeting Sabine Goddard overshadowed seeing Aphrodite again. She told herself it was because she had so many questions about the perfect match. But if she was perfectly honest, those viridescent eyes had burned into her the moment she turned the textbook page, and she had been singed ever since.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?